Short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Matthew Smith, producer of Vermont Edition, and I wanted to say thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Did it work? It's actually not a question you often hear after announcements about government programs aimed at helping a particular industry or a new initiative to boost the Vermont brand. There's a big, splashy announcement, maybe some funding that comes along with the kickoff, but months or years down the line, there's that question. Did it work? The answers aren't so easy to figure out, actually. How do we know if these programs actually delivered on their promises, if they were ultimately a good use of taxpayer dollars? Well, VPR reporter and All Things Considered host Henry Epp wanted to find the answers. He produced a series of stories exploring the singular question about publicly funded programs in Vermont, both big and small. Did it work? The series followed up on a handful of initiatives over the past few years and looked at how much bang, if any, Vermonters got for their bucks. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to listen back to the series of investigations put together by a handful of VPR reporters. So let's jump right in with a story about efforts to bring Vermont food products to the Boston public market. Here's series producer Henry Epp talking to reporter Howard Weiss Tisman about that project.
So a few years ago, the state wanted to sell and market Vermont products in downtown Boston. So can you tell us just a little bit about how it was supposed to work?
Sure. Well, back in 2014, the legislature passed the Vermont Domestic Export Program. It brought together the Agency of Agriculture with the Department of Tourism and Marketing to use local food products to promote Vermont in other states. There was money for promotional materials. There were grants to send food producers to trade shows around the country. And over 2 years, the state invested $25,000 in a stall at the Boston Public Market. Here's what Chelsea Bardo Lewis from the Agency of Agriculture told VPR at the time.
We could see this as a potential Vermont embassy in Massachusetts. So not only a place where the product would be sold retail, but also a place for the producers to come down, sample their products, maybe have meetings with wholesalers who are based in the Boston area.
Okay, so a Vermont embassy in Massachusetts. That sounds pretty interesting. So the state used $25,000 for this program, and they partnered with a farmer who was supposed to run the market stall. Is that right?
That's the way it was supposed to work. The market opened in July of 2015, and Paul Harlow from Harlow Farm in Westminster helped run the stand in Boston. It was called Harlow's Vermont Farm Stand, and Paul sold his organic produce there, along with some other Vermont products. The idea was that folks in Boston would buy this beautiful Vermont produce and then hopefully come up to apple pick or go to a restaurant or something along those lines.
Okay, so did it work?
Well, I went to visit Paul on his farm to find out. The Harlow family has been farming this rich Connecticut River soil in Westminster for more than 100 years. And so when the state needed an ambassador to represent Vermont's agricultural community, it made a lot of sense to ask Paul Harlow.
Those are sea potatoes from Chappelle.
Harlow sells most of his produce wholesale, and he runs one of the biggest organic vegetable farms in New England. So he knows the business as well as anyone. The Agency of Agriculture approached him in early 2015 and said they had a stall at the brand new Boston Public Market. They said Harlow could represent the state and sell his produce to Boston consumers, who were hungry for a taste of those good Vermont fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, it was a way for us to diversify, and, you know, we were in for the money. Plus the, you know, I don't want to say we were helping out the state, but I guess in some ways that's what we're doing.
The Agency of Agriculture secured the market space, and the state gave Harlow a $25,000 grant to cover startup costs. But Harlow had to sink a bunch of his own money into the project as well. He had to buy coolers and truck his stuff to Boston and hire staff to work the stall. And he had to cover the monthly $4,500 rent for the prime Boston real estate. The market opened late summer. The sales were not near what they projected. But Harlow's a farmer, and farmers always hold out hope for the next growing season.
You know, all through that winter, I don't recall exactly, but sales weren't great. But it was, you know, we could always say, well, come springtime, we'll have all new fresh stuff and things will improve. They didn't.
Harlow says they had a great spot right near the entrance. And in the height of the season, the crates were busting with beautiful greens and root crops and berries. But as that second season wore on, Harlow found himself deeper and deeper in a financial hole.
You know, what it turned out to be was more of a food stall, a food emporium, because they there are several places serve lunches and a tourist attraction.
I went down to visit the Boston Market on a recent Wednesday afternoon, and there was a good crowd there.
Yeah, that's a sweet roasted cashew. That is cinnamon,
no,
vanilla.
No, not cashew, peanuts.
Oh, sweet roasted peanut, yes.
Oh, okay, because I'm allergic to cashew.
This is a woman who seemed pretty excited about the spiced nuts for sale. There were donuts and ice cream, soap and wooden bowls. I had a pretty good pastrami sandwich, but there were only two produce stands. Boston Public Market CEO Cheryl Cronin says when the market first opened, there were six farms, and everyone thought there'd be a lot more sales of fresh fruits and vegetables.
I do think perhaps when the market got started, there were lots of hope for how much produce you could have here that would be successful. So I think the issue was less that folks didn't succeed. It was more that the original planning, the notion of having five or six different produce farmers here wasn't realistic.
Cronin says Harlow wasn't the only farmer who couldn't make a go of it. And coming all the way from Vermont made it that much harder. Abby Willard is with the Vermont Agency of Agriculture and acknowledged the stand never met its sale goals. But Willard says the Boston Public Market project was about much more than just selling Vermont food products. In between the cases of kale and carrots, there were copies of Vermont Life magazine and brochures about agritourism and food festivals.
Sometimes we don't see increased sales or benefits for multiple years, but we are confident and convinced that it's the long game investment in exposing new consumers and new regions to Vermont products that's worth the ongoing investment.
Willard says the state considered it a success. Paul Harlow sees it much differently.
It is a disaster, to tell you the truth. I wish we hadn't done it.
Harlow says he paid his staff and all the Vermont producers whose food products he sold. But he says he lost about $200,000 between the 2 years he was there.
I got one little table, a little small table. That's all I've got out of it. You know, we're taking a chance. But it, at the time, it did seem like a great idea, you know.
Wow. So, Howard, there's no longer a Vermont food stand at the Boston Public Market.
Yeah, that's right. Paul said after the first year, the Agency of Ag convinced him to stick it out. But after the second season, it was clear that the produce sales couldn't sustain the project.
Okay, so again, did it work?
Not really. I mean, there's no longer a Vermont presence at the market. And Harlow lost a bunch of money in the process. But the Agency of Ag sees it more as an investment. And they believe, or hope anyway, that there is a long-term payoff.
That was VPR's Howard Weiss-Tisman talking with Henry Epp for the series Did It Work? Now let's hear a story Henry did himself, one looking at efforts to get low- and moderate-income Vermonters into electric cars. Epp focused on a package of incentives and rebates offered by the Burlington Electric Department starting in 2017. So, did it work? Here's Henry's story.
It's a bright, sunny morning in Burlington, Vermont, in early October 2017. Leaders of electric utilities, a car dealership, Governor Phil Scott, and Mayor Murrah Weinberger are lined up behind a podium in the parking lot of Burlington Electric Department. The head of Burlington Electric steps up to the mic.
Well, we're gonna get started. We're gonna get started. Well, welcome to Burlington Electric. My name is Neil Lunderville. I'm the general manager here at Burlington Electric, and we're so happy to have you on this great fall day. It's a great solar day, but it's an even better electric vehicle day.
All these officials are here to announce new incentives and rebates aimed at getting Vermonters to buy electric cars. Many speakers emphasize they're offering rebates to make electric vehicles more affordable to more people. Here's how Neil Lunderville explained it at the time.
We need to make sure that low and moderate income Vermonters are able to access every part of the energy revolution. And electric vehicles are one very tangible way where they can save money and do good for the environment.
In the first year, Burlington Electric spent nearly $40,000 on its EV rebate program with the promise to spend more in the years to come. So since 2017, how many low or moderate income Burlington Electric customers bought electric cars with those rebates? Okay, so here's what Burlington Electric started offering back in 2017. If you buy a new all-electric car or plug-in hybrid and you qualify as low or moderate income, you can get an $1,800 rebate. They also offered a smaller rebate for customers above that income bracket. So in the last year and a half, how many low or moderate income BED customers got the highly touted rebate? Three. One of them is Linda Provost.
Hi, Linda.
I am.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Come on in.
Sure, thanks.
Or do you want to go out first?
Sure, we could do that first.
Let me grab a coat.
Okay.
I met Provost at her house in the Old North End on a sunny, snowy day back in February. She's semi-retired, but still does some freelance work and runs a bed and breakfast out of her home. We walked out to her car parked in the driveway.
This is a 2017 Chevy Bolt.
Provost is leasing this car for about $250 a month. Plus, she spent about $1,200 to buy and install an EV charger. Her Bolt is a shiny, compact hatchback, plastered with patches of snow, like any Vermont car in midwinter.
Do you want to test drive it all?
I'll watch you drive it.
Do you want that?
Sure,
I love this car.
Okay, yeah, let's do it.
It's a smooth, quiet ride as we cruise around the block. And Provost says, for the most part, she doesn't really take it all that much farther than around the block.
97% of my driving is within 50 miles. In the summertime, I get about 350-mile range. In the wintertime, it's about 128.
It's just because of the snow and
because of the cold.
Oh, okay.
The battery is always keeping itself between 68 and 72 degrees, so that's what uses up energy in the wintertime.
Provost is getting to one issue that's kept many people skeptical of electric cars, the range they can drive before the battery runs out. Another issue, price. Provost says she really wanted to buy an electric car. She's concerned about climate change, but she wouldn't have leased the Bolt without what she says was a great deal she received from the dealer.
And the rebate just really helped.
Given that only three people have signed up, despite all the hype, how does Burlington Electric feel about the results of the rebate program? I put that question to the utility's new manager, Darren Springer.
I mean, do you consider overall this program a success?
I consider it a starting point, really. I think we want to do much, much more in this space. We want to make it so that every customer who is interested in electric vehicles can access them.
Springer says the rebate is not just about helping low-income people join the energy revolution. It's also to help BED meet a state mandate.
We offer this under Vermont's Renewable Energy Standard, Tier 3, which essentially says to utilities, we want you to reduce fossil fuel use and emissions in the heating sector and in the transportation sector.
And if they don't, at a certain level, BED would have to pay the state, Springer says. According to BED, beyond the three lower moderate income customers who used the $1,800 rebate, another 77 people with higher incomes used a lower rebate. In total, over $85,000 in ratepayer money has been spent to help BED customers buy EVs or plug-in hybrids. And BED is not the only utility to offer this kind of program. Green Mountain Power has several incentives for its customers to switch to EVs, including a rebate. Well over 400 GMP customers have used those incentives since 2017. Meanwhile, Governor Phil Scott has proposed spending $1.5 million on new electric vehicle rebates, and advocates are pushing for much more. Rob Roper, head of the libertarian-leaning Ethan Allen Institute, is no fan of programs like these when they use ratepayer or taxpayer dollars.
If people want to buy electric vehicles, great. I mean, you know, some of these cars are really cool, and I think that the technology will eventually take off. But this should be a decision that's made by individual people. And for the state to come along and say, I'm going to tax you, Peter, to put Paul in a Tesla, that does not seem like a just use of government power or a fair use of taxpayer funds.
Utility executives at BED and GMP argue rebates are a way of accelerating adoption of new technology and helping Vermont reduce its carbon footprint. So now back to the question that we're asking this week. Did it work? Well, more new EVs are on the road. But the number of low and moderate income Vermonters that were helped by this program, they're kind of minuscule. To hear Linda Provost, the owner of the Chevy Bolt in Burlington, tell it, though, it worked for her. She wants to do her part to combat climate change, and she feels like she is doing something.
I feel a little virtuous. But if I couldn't afford it, I wouldn't be able to feel virtuous.
That's Henry Epp reporting for our series, Did It Work?, on electric vehicle incentives offered by Burlington Electric Department. Let's turn now to a story that was reported by Liam Elder Connors. He investigated a 2015 pledge by then-Governor Peter Shumlin to invest millions of dollars in Vermont's child protection system. One goal of the initiative was to reduce caseloads for social workers in the Department for Children and Families. Here's Henry Epp in conversation with Liam Elder Connors about the tragedy that spurred Governor Shumlin to launch the program and at whether caseloads are any lower now, nearly 3 years later.
In 2014, two infants under the watch of the Vermont Department for Children and Families died. The deaths put DCF under a microscope, revealing a system that was understaffed and overwhelmed with cases. Near the end of 2015, then-Governor Peter Shumlin announced a plan to invest millions of dollars in Vermont's child protection system.
Well, this won't solve all of our problems, and there will be more tragedies ahead, without a doubt. This is a step in the right direction. It's an investment we must make.
The $8.4 million plan called for hiring more than 40 workers across the child protection system, including 28 new caseworkers. Shortly after the plan was announced, DCF Commissioner Ken Schatz told Vermont Edition that these were necessary resources.
That we've definitely seen this substantial increase in terms of reports of abuse and neglect increasing substantially. Our numbers of children coming into custody has increased substantially. We clearly recognize the need for more resources for our social worker staff.
By increasing staff, DCF hoped to bring caseloads down from nearly 18 per worker to 16. The legislature signed off on the plan. Now, nearly 3 years after the investment, are caseloads any lower? VPR's Liam Elder Connors has been looking into this question. Hey, Liam.
Hi, Henry.
So what happened with this proposal?
So after those child deaths in 2014, an advisory board recommended a number of changes.
The main finding within DCF was that we were understaffed.
This is Joe Hagan, a pediatrician in Burlington. In 2014, he was co-chair of the Vermont Citizen Advisory Board. The group found that DCF social workers had significantly higher caseloads than the nationally recommended 12 cases per worker.
The average, if I recall correctly, was somewhere around 17 or 18 cases. So we right away called that to the attention of the governor.
Not all of the $8.4 million approved went to DCF, but most of the money went towards hiring social workers. The department ultimately added 20 family service workers in the hopes of reducing caseloads. But that didn't exactly happen. Caseloads are slightly down to around 17, but that's still above DCF's goal. The biggest problem is that while supply of caseworkers has increased, the demand for their services has increased even more. DCF says the number of child protection cases has risen by 33% since 2013. Karen Shea, DCF Deputy Commissioner, says the totals are a combination of three things: how many cases come in, how long they're in the system, and how many leave.
All three parts are not working perfectly. So you have more cases coming into the system than you did 5 years ago. You have longer lengths of stay because you have delays in the court process because you have more cases going into that flow. And you have fewer who exit as a result of, you know, the delays in the systems.
Shea says opioid abuse is a factor in the increase.
Roughly two-thirds of our caseload have substance use disorders as a factor in the child custody episode, and about 50% of cases it's opioid use disorder for children under age 5.
But Larry Crist, the executive director of Vermont Parent Representation Center, thinks high caseloads are the result of DCF being too aggressive in opening investigations.
We are assigning these workers to work they shouldn't be engaged in.
VPRC is a nonprofit that provides legal advocacy for people involved in the state's child protection system. Christ says DCF opens too many cases where abuse or neglect is a concern but isn't actually happening.
We should be using our resources to focus on determining which families are really, where kids are really at danger, instead of saying, we're just going to open cases and monitor families to make sure that nothing ever happens on our watch.
Deputy DCF Commissioner Shea says she understands the criticism, but says state law is clear about when the department needs to respond.
The statute and the regulation is pretty clear about what our obligation is to respond to situations that create risk for children. And I think that there's an intention around that to try to get involved at a point where we can intervene before harm occurs.
So, Liam, did this funding increase to DCF work?
Not really. Caseloads did decrease, but only got to about halfway of their target level. But advocates and officials don't see it as a failure. Bennington County State Senator Dick Sears thinks the money was well spent.
Without those increases, we'd be in real trouble today.
Sears is a member of the Joint Legislative Child Protection Oversight Committee.
I mean, it's not to suggest that everything's fine, but and we continue to improve. But I would hate to have seen us trying to deal with this crisis if we hadn't had the increases in the numbers a few years ago.
At this point, the story's come full circle. Officials say social workers are still overburdened and understaffed, and this year, Governor Phil Scott proposed a $2 million initiative that includes hiring more family service workers. Their new goal, 15 cases per worker.
That was reporter Liam Elder Connors with his Did It Work investigation into millions of dollars in new funding for more caseworkers at Vermont's Department for Children and Families. Now let's go to Japan. Well, not really to Japan, but to efforts to take Vermont products to the Japanese market. About 4 years ago, Vermont's Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets secured $25,000 in federal grants for a trade mission to Japan. Eight small food producers and a handful of state employees headed to Tokyo for 4 days in October of 2016. Their goal was to drum up new business for Vermont's specialty products like maple syrup or apple cider. So, did the grant help those companies make any new sales in Japan? Henry Epp caught up with Chelsea Bardot-Lewis, head of business development at the agency at the time, to find out.
The grant had specific goals. Within 3 years, increase sales to Japan for these eight small food producers by $200,000 and by $500,000 within 5 years. And they were essentially starting from scratch. Just one of the companies went into the trip with any sales to Japan, and those were less than $10,000 per year. We'll get to how those sales goals have turned out in just a bit. But first, why Japan? Chelsea Bardot-Lewis says the idea actually came from some Vermont maple producers because it turns out Japan consumes a lot of maple syrup.
Japan being the third largest market for maple syrup in the world, we started talking about what we could do in Japan. There wasn't a lot of awareness about Vermont, and the Canadians have really beat us to the international market, and there is a story that if it's not Canadian maple syrup, then it's fake.
So how better to tell Japanese consumers that a small state just south of Canada also makes real maple syrup? Go tell them. So Bardot-Lewis got the federal grant and booked a contractor in Japan who could connect Vermont companies to potential buyers.
And she had identified pretty early on that there are some really nice synergies between Japan and Vermont. The mountains, the interest in pure and artisanal products.
And there are some big Vermont brands that are pretty well established in Japan.
Burton, Ben & Jerry's.
Oh, also by coincidence, one of the most popular curry brands in Japan is for some reason called Vermont Curry. Seven Days had an article recently looking into how that name came about. Look it up if you're interested. Anyways, Bardot-Lewis, along with representatives of the eight companies and a few other government officials, headed to Tokyo for 4 days in late October 2016. There were seminars, meetings with potential buyers, and a Taste of the Green Mountains event where companies showcased their products at a local restaurant.
And there were a number of influencers there, social media, other PR folks, as well as some buyers.
Bardot-Lewis says just one company made a sale during the trip. And something they all learned in the process?
It takes a long time, particularly apparently in the Japanese market. It's very relationship driven.
What, Colin, the shipment went out 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, to Nagano Trading.
That's so David Dalgano, co-founder of Shaxbury Cider in Vergennes, confirming with his business partner, Colin Davis, that yes, their very first shipment of cider is on its way to Japan.
I suspect right now it's somewhere in the middle of the Pacific, which is really an exciting thing to imagine.
Shaxbury was one of the 8 Vermont businesses on that trip. The company is growing. It was hard to find a quiet spot to talk. There's jackhammering above their main facility as they get ready to expand to a second floor. When we do find a quiet place, Dalgano tells me the reasons it's taken 3 years to actually sell to Japan. First, they've had other priorities, like keeping up with demand in the U.S., and it took a while to find the right Japanese distributor. But they finally found one who can handle everything once their pallets of cider leave Vergennes.
And from the point at which they get put onto the truck and trucked across the country to then get put onto a cargo ship to then be shipped across the ocean to then be put on into a warehouse in Japan and shipped on smaller trucks all throughout Japan, that whole process is managed by Nagano Trading.
This first shipment from Shaxbury, it's worth about $15,000. In a report shortly after the trip, the Vermont Agency of Agriculture said the company's projected $70,000 in initial sales, and the report promised to follow up with the companies a year on. But grant reports from subsequent years don't show that that follow-up occurred, and a current agency official said the agency does not have any further information. So if the state government didn't track it, who knows how many sales were made to Japan after this trip? Well, these companies do, so I called them.
We haven't had any export sales to Japan since or before.
So it was clear that it was just not going to be a viable market for us in the short term.
We had immediate success. I would say that we shipped within months of returning home.
That's Christy Menard of Springbrook Farm, Kurt Alpeter of Runamuck Maple, and Rob Houseline, also known as Sugar Bob, of Sugar Bob's Finest Kind. All told, 3 of the 8 small Vermont specialty food producers who went on this trip said they made sales to Japan. One did not return multiple requests for comment. Tallying together company estimates, there's been a total of about $55,000 in sales. Again, the goal was $200,000 within 3 years, so sales have fallen short so far. But every business person I spoke to, even the ones who haven't made sales, said the trip was worth it. Here's Kurt Alpeter again.
It was an opportunity for us to do something that we could never have done, independently.
So now to that question we're asking, did it work? On a pure numbers level, no. $55,000 is not $200,000. But it does mean some extra money is coming in to growing companies like Shaxbury Cider. The company's co-founder, David Dalgano, says the trip was a catalyst for the company to reach a new market.
To be able to sell what looks like it will amount to be a really substantive amount of cider into this new market that we otherwise probably wouldn't be selling in, or certainly not for several more years. And so the tens of thousands of dollars that will be for our company, will translate to us paying our workers here and paying our taxes here and growing our business here in Vermont.
As for those other companies, many of them are still optimistic they'll eventually make sales too.
That was Henry Epp investigating a grant program to take Vermont products to market in Japan. Today we're listening to a VPR series called Did It Work? Reporters identified a handful of projects that launched with big aspirations and public dollars, and have had some time to either find success or not. So the reporters were trying to figure out the answer to the question, did it work? Now a look at wood stoves and a state program to update them. 2 years ago, Vermont offered incentives for residents to buy a new wood or pellet stove, provided they got rid of their older, more pollution-prone one. The program was so popular, they did it again this year, but with a few changes. Series producer Henry Epp and reporter Amy Noyes looked at how many people took advantage of the wood stove changeout program.
So a few years ago, the state offered up a couple $100,000 to help people update the old wood stoves in their homes.
That's right. Vermont's Clean Energy Development Fund put up $200,000 to persuade homeowners to switch out their old wood stoves for models that meet newer federal clean air standards.
Okay, so before we get to the money, can you explain those clean air standards?
Yeah, it's pretty complicated. So I asked David Kufall to explain it to me. He's the president of Hearthstone. It's a wood stove manufacturer in Morrisville. He says in 1988, the Environmental Protection Agency started setting emission limits that are measured in grams per hour of dust particles coming out of your chimney. And for new stoves on the market, those limits became more restrictive in 2015.
The existing EPA standard has been 7.5 grams an hour. And in 2015, anything that wasn't under 4.5 grams an hour became obsolete.
Okay, so how do the new stoves burn cleaner?
So they burn off more soot, those dust particles, so they don't go up the chimney. And Kufall says the newest stoves burn everything 3 times.
We've always had primary combustion, which is your basic fire. Then we had secondary combustion, which would burn off the gases. And now we've got tertiary combustion through a catalytic combustor, not unlike your automobile. And that takes the final amounts of CO in whatever form it is, or just plain old carbon, and burns it one more time.
So does that also make the stoves more efficient?
Yes. Kufall says with a new stove, you'll go through about half as much wood as with the older models from the 70s and 80s.
Okay, so the state's goal was to give away money as an incentive for people to switch to cleaner and more efficient stoves. So did it work?
It did. In fact, so many people took advantage of the program that the initial $200,000 was gone in a couple months. So the state kicked in another $100,000 to keep the program going. Andrew Perchlik is in charge of the program for the Clean Energy Development Fund. He's also a state senator, and I caught up with him at the State House. Here's his take on it.
Well, I think for the first season, it worked very well. And one, we got a lot of stove changed out in a short amount of time. And we also learned things.
So that first program gave away $300,000 during the winter of 2016 to 2017, and 247 old wood stoves were switched out for new wood or pellet stoves. But the program was kind of complicated. There were 4 different incentive amounts ranging from $500 to $1,500, depending on how clean the new stove burned. So the cleaner the stove, the higher the incentive. And most people went for the $1,500, as Perchlik explains.
We learned, one, that maybe that top incentive was too high. We also learned that there wasn't as much of a connection to how clean the stove was to the cost. The reason we did $1,500 incentive last time is those were for the most clean-burning stoves, the most efficient. But we found out that the most efficient wasn't necessarily the most expensive.
Perchlik says they also learned there should be some form of low-income component to the program. So when they brought the program back this winter, they implemented some changes. First, they increased the overall pool to $400,000, and they created a few different programs. So there's a program specifically for lower-income Vermonters, and there's still a program open to anyone with a pre-1988 wood stove to change out. But the incentives are flat this time around, $1,000 for a pellet stove or $800 for a new cordwood stove. And it's only good towards stoves that meet the newest EPA standards, which actually go into effect next year. And there's also a third program run through Efficiency Vermont, which offers a $650 incentive to people who don't have an older stove to exchange.
I'll get you a book too.
It's a lot to negotiate, but fortunately, participating wood stove dealers like Peter Lesperance at Chimney Sweep 2 in Berlin are well-versed in the changing EPA standards and the various incentive programs in Vermont. Essentially, Lesperance says the goal is for Vermonters to get rid of wood stoves made in the 70s.
Basically, those stoves have an efficiency of less than 50% and do create a fair amount of air pollution.
So is the new revised incentive program working as well as the program from a couple years ago?
Well, it's still too early to know. So far, 112 old wood stoves have been changed out under the new program, compared to 247 in the old program. So it's off to a much slower start. But retailers say they're still busy. And the money can only be used for the wood stoves that meet the 2020 EPA standards, which are even stricter than the 2015 standards. So from an air quality standpoint, there could be a greater impact even if fewer stoves are switched over.
So does the program keep going until this money runs out?
Sort of. Andrew Perchlich says this program will run until July 1st. And if there's still money left in the pot, they may make a few more tweaks and set a new end date for the program.
So could the incentive amounts change again?
They definitely could. Here's what Perchlich had to say about that.
This is public money, and so we want to make sure we're using it as efficiently as possible and getting the biggest bang for the buck. So, yeah, we're trying to set that incentive that moves people to do this change out because we think it's the public good if people change out these old stoves. But we don't want to over-incentivize. If they're going to do it anyway, we don't want to just give them money to do it. So that is the balance that you do when you run an incentive program.
So even though they may change the program again, Perchlich says he still believes it's working.
That was VPR reporter Amy Noyes with her story on Vermont's wood stove replacement program. That story was part of a series of investigations VPR aired earlier this year called Did It Work?, which followed up on a handful of initiatives that used public dollars. Today we've heard five stories, and series producer Henry Epp and other reporters at VPR are already working on another batch. VPR's Morning Edition host Mitch Wortlieb spoke with Henry Epp to talk about what he learned from his first round of stories and to get a preview of what he and others are working on for the next round.
So, Henry, I'm so curious, what made you want to ask the question in the first place, did it work?
Well, so, Mitch, it really came from being a reporter over a number of years and a host and a journalist and going to press conferences and ribbon cuttings and seeing government officials unveil funding for a project. And you know, we cover that. We get it in our newscasts. We get it on the air. But, you know, we don't always follow through and see what happened to that big announcement a couple years down the line. So it's really, you know, easy to get a press release, go to a press conference as a reporter, but we're not always like putting it in our calendars to go and check back on that thing 3 years later. So it was really my idea to just, you know, look back at some of those things and really just see, did it work? Did something that public officials said was going to happen actually happen?
So outline the criteria for us. Some of these were state programs you looked at. Others were federal grants. What else?
Well, so basically the main criteria was that there was some amount of public money behind a project, and it had to have a specific dollar amount that we could point to. It had to be at least a year old. That, you know, enables the program to have some time to see whether it did, you know, work out as intended or not. So one example of something that wasn't necessarily state money, but Burlington Electric. It's a public utility, so that's ratepayer money. The piece we heard about trying to drum up business for some Vermont companies in Japan, that was part of a federal grant that came to the state. So that's federal taxpayer money. So we're not just talking about, you know, Montpelier or state spending here. It's a lot of different public sources of money, federal, public utilities, and state funds.
Was this kind of a gotcha thing? I mean, did you go out looking for programs you thought were abuses of government spending?
No, you know, it really wasn't. It really came from a genuine curiosity of trying to know and find out whether things panned out as they were planned or as they were hoped to pan out. There were some where I had an inkling that things might not have worked out very well. And, you know, that's where a lot of curiosity comes from. You know, I went to this Burlington Electric press conference back in 2017 where they were unveiling incentives for low and moderate income Vermonters for electric cars. And, you know, sort of being there in the moment and thinking, huh, I wonder if this is actually going to go how folks intend it to go. So that was, you know, sort of the spark of it, thinking, let's check back and see where that goes.
So not necessarily looking for problems, but I wonder if you were surprised then to find that a lot of these programs really did not work.
I think it's not a terribly surprising. Some were sort of creative experiments in government. The Japan story comes to mind, for example, where, you know, the dollar amount wasn't huge. It was $25,000, where the state said, let's see if we can drum up something that we wouldn't normally do. So it wasn't a huge surprise that they didn't work. It was interesting to see how things sort of fade from the radar pretty quickly.
Talk about how this is different from the reporting of other stories that you've worked on, because you're having to pass some judgment here on whether or not something worked, that, you know, to make the process different. I mean, you are adding some subjectivity to this, I would imagine.
So it's a little different, mostly because we're looking into things that aren't necessarily new news, right? And in some ways, it's almost like re-reporting news from a couple of years ago and then tracing that story forward. And that's not always easy to do. Sometimes the people involved have sort of forgotten about the project or they've moved on. But I think we're careful about passing judgment. If there's a stated benchmark to a program and it missed that benchmark, then it's pretty easy to say, okay, that didn't work. But in a lot of cases, it's more nuanced, where there's someone involved in the program that says, okay, we didn't have success in terms of our benchmark, but there may be a silver lining. I think of the Japan story, for example, where they did not hit the dollar amounts of sales to Japan that they were seeking. But a lot of the companies that were involved said, you know, this brought us to a market and introduced us to a market that we probably wouldn't have gone for without this grant. You know, another example is this story about DCF we heard where there were public officials saying, okay, we didn't reduce caseloads to a point that we wanted to, but it would have been worse if we hadn't made this investment in caseworkers for DCF.
Henry, I'm curious, too, about the time factor you mentioned. You said you wanted to give at least a year for a lot of these programs to find out, you know, did it work? Did anyone you speak with say, look, we haven't had enough time yet to assess success or failure here. We need more time.
No one said that explicitly. But, you know, I think there are definitely some examples in this series of projects. I'd say the electric vehicle incentive is one where, you know, that incentive is still out there. The Burlington Electric Department is still offering it. And so, you know, there are things where these are programs that aren't, you know, completely finished and may have different results later on.
So, Henry, you found just one program of the five that you're looking into that was, we can call it, unmitigated success. What are your thoughts on that success rate?
Well, you know, it's not like we're taking a scientific sample of government spending. We're picking stories that are interesting stories to report on and tell on the radio. And, you know, it's kind of interesting when something doesn't totally go according to plan or when there's some nuance. So I don't think, you know, it speaks badly necessarily of government spending as a whole that like all that, you know, many of these didn't work out. But I think it more speaks to that it's interesting when a story has nuance and complexity and we want to tell that story.
Yeah. And you, as you said at the beginning, you want to follow this through, too, because so often we hear about programs then we don't hear about them again. This is a way to say we're paying attention to what it is that's being proposed here. And it is, again, public.
Exactly.
Public money here. You are working on a new round of stories for later this summer. What can you tell us about those?
Yeah. So we're working on bringing the series back for later this summer. Right now, I'm looking into this one very long planned project that would bring Amtrak passenger train service up from Rutland to Burlington. It's the Ethan Allen Express line. And this program actually stems from an earmark that former Senator Jim Jeffords got in the late 90s. And the train service is not expected to arrive in Burlington until about 2021 or possibly 2022.
Is it frustrating?
Oh, absolutely. It's terribly frustrating. But it's not like there's been a deliberate conspiracy to sabotage the train. Government projects take forever.
So that's Mitch. That's Carl Fowler. He's a longtime passenger rail advocate in Vermont, and he's been following this project, this plan to bring a passenger train service to Burlington for years. And like you heard, he said it's frustrating that it's taken almost 25 years, but he is still optimistic that someday there will be a train that comes to Burlington. Other VPR reporters will also be contributing stories to this series. And if the stories we've heard today are any precedent, I think we should have some really interesting pieces to share with you later.
That's VPR's Henry Epp. Thank you so much, Henry.
Thanks, Mitch.
That was VPR's Mitch Wortlieb talking with Did It Work? Producer Henry Epp. If you have thoughts for projects to follow up on, you can send your ideas to news@vpr.org. Use the subject line, Did It Work? Did It Work? Was created and produced by Henry Epp, with reporting by Howard Weiss-Tisman, Liam Elder Connors, and Amy Noyes. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Matthew Smith. Our intern is Olivia White. Our show directors are Jake Rusnak, Mary Engish, and Mary Carol Maganzini. VPR's digital producers are Meg Malone and Elodie Reed. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.